Welcome to What You Know About RJ, sharing stories and skills about restorative justice, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. I'm your host, Gilbert Salazar. In this season, we are asking CCJ school partners to share their wisdom regarding culture, relationships, and justice in schools. I wish that you who are listening could see this amazing person across the Zoom screen from me right now. She's a person I've known for a long time, even officially before I began with CCJ, even early on in my RJ work. She's been doing the work of RJ before me, and I'm so happy to be in space with her and to pass the mic now so she can introduce herself.
Oh, well, thanks, Gilbert.
You're welcome. It's true.
Very generous introduction. I'm Suzanne Caverly, and I'm a principal in Long Beach, and I am really happy to be here today. I'm so happy. We were talking before we started recording just about how great it is to have an opportunity to connect. And so, you know, I'm really looking forward to that, in addition to sharing, you know, the work with our listeners. Just connecting with you, Gilbert, is really a privilege and a blessing for me. So I also just want to say that, you know, in my role here in the conversation is that I'm really not here to be a spokesperson for my school district or for my school, but rather, you know, I'm a CCEJ volunteer. I'm a student of restorative and racial justice. And so, you know, what we're talking about today is really my part in a journey, you know, kind of where I am on the walk of becoming more restorative. And so, you know, I just really wanted to highlight that before we start that, you know, all the things we're going to be talking about today from my perspective are someone else's ideas, you know, people who I've read, people who I've heard, people who I've worked with in the past. You know, it's a collective work, and I am a part of, you know, that story. And so I just really wanted to frame that today, you know, that it's through real humility, and I'm in awe of the work that's being done, and you know, proud to be a part of it, but, you know, just knowing that my place in that work is small and humble, and I'm grateful to be a part of today. So thanks, Gilbert.
To begin, what has RJ taught you? What have you learned from RJ?
Wow. yeah. So, you know, we already kind of referred to just the restorative justice, you know, work as being a journey. But I would also call it a lifestyle, you know, and it's, I would say that a goal that I have on a daily basis, and it's actually something that I articulate and that I really think through in my mind on a regular basis, is how do I become more restorative? You know, kind of really going back to that frame all of the time of what it is to behave and think and relate, connect and administrate in a restorative frame and from that paradigm and through that lens. And, you know, I really like, you know, Ted Watchell and a lot of other folks have adopted and have revised that frame, that restorative frame that has the two, not the with and the for. And I have that in my office. I have one in my purse, you know, where I really think about staying in that with box, you know, that that everything that I'm doing in when I'm making decisions or when I'm relating is that it is with people, that I'm never doing things to or for people, and never passing a responsibility, never being neglectful of a responsibility to act, but rather that I'm with people. And so for me, you know, that is a foundation of my professional life, but it has also very much driven my personal life and my relationships and the way that I've parented and been a member of my family. So, wow. The other thing I will say is that restorative justice, its practices and its concepts and its frame has kept me in the profession of education. You know, I think that I came to, and I know, you know, this isn't necessarily part of the question, but I will just say briefly that I really came to restorative justice through, you know, the training, and, you know, I can't kind of came to CCEJ looking for another way, you know, really looking for another way. And I found so much more than I even thought I would find.
You mentioned power with, which makes you think about the, and I understand that for me, my own journey, and I think about the internal work I continue to have to do each day to maintain a space of power with. I'm curious if there's anything you could share about what's anything internal that's happening to you to be able to make a conscious choice around power with.
So my thinking around that is that to do something to someone is punitive, you know, and that is not who I want to be. You know, that is who I was as a teacher in my early years in the classroom, but that is not who I want to be. To do something for someone is enabling. You know, when I offer my service or my help when it is not invited or when it's not really needed, or in a way that actually robs someone of their dignity, you know, that's really for enabling is not something that I want to be either. And then to just be in fear or to be negligent or disinterested in the well-being of another is to be in that not box. And so I think that being with is really so much about what restorative justice is about. It's about community. You know, it's about building those connections that actually keep us from wanting to harm one another and that actually help us to restore relationships once we've harmed, you know, people. Mm-hmm. So I think the motivation to be with is knowing that it helps me to avoid those other very harmful behaviors. You know, we're not going to be perfect ever, but when we have a target, when we have a goal of being the best that we can be, it lands in that with box. Mm.
You know, we have about 17, 18 sort of beliefs, and one of them is shared joy and vulnerability build meaningful connection. I wonder if there's anything you could share about your own experience with that statement.
Oh, it's one of the things I love so much about one of the restorative practices that we enjoy, which is circle. So to me, you know, joy and vulnerability is really what we build when we go to circle. You know, a lot of times we open a circle with a game that can bring us a lot of joy, and we can find even people, real, you know, mature adults like myself who take ourselves really seriously, we end up giggling and laughing and, you know, enjoying, you know, a childlike play that can bring joy, but also break down kind of that overly serious adultish kind of trap that I think we get into, particularly in the workplace. And through that joy and that kind of breaking down of that adultish posture that we bring sometimes to the workplace, we end up becoming ready for vulnerability through sharing. And then through that vulnerable sharing, through that real storytelling, that real truth telling that we can create and experience in circle, we create those lasting connections that then perpetuate that cycle of joy and vulnerability every time that same group of people comes together. People have that collective memory, they have that shared experience, and it creates a culture around that group of people and through the practice in you know, this scenario that we're talking about now, through that practice of circle. You know, but there's a lot of other ways, you know, that we can bring joy and vulnerability. And, you know, some of the things that we can do as leaders, and, you know, that's the context that I speak from, are to, you know, to create symbols and common language that, you know, through joyful experiences that are outside of circle. You know, at a school site, when I have to deliver a difficult professional development or, you know, some hard information or challenging things, I really enjoy creating a theme around it. Not to poke fun at the topic or the information or to, you know, decrease its impact, but rather to create a safer, never always safe, right? Mm-hmm. But a safer feeling, and then let's have some fun with it. This year we had a lot of data to look at the beginning of the school year, a lot of data, heavy, heavy numbers to look at. And our leadership team thought it would be fun to do a gardening theme for that meeting. You know, it's silly, but it brought joy to our group, you know, and it helped them to receive the data that we were looking at in a more vulnerable posture. You know, they weren't coming at it as adults looking at data and, you know, resisting some of the negative things that, you know, some of the hard numbers we wanted to look at, it created just a softer feeling in the room where we were giggling about, we wore gardening gloves through the whole thing, and you know, you know, and so it didn't feel so doomsday. You know? But I think that we can always have opportunity to create joy, especially if we want to create vulnerability. I think that we need to do that to break down that overly serious posture, I think, that sometimes we take. Mm.
You mentioned doing all of the work of culture building with joy and vulnerability to be able to, if needed, give news that is not so easy, or to have to filter through data. For folks who are unfamiliar with the work, or for folks who come with a lens of, the word we could use is resistance, trying to protect something about themselves, why would you say it's important that adults on a campus or in a workplace, why it's important for them to be in community?
Oh my goodness. Nice. You know, really, yeah, really without it, we're not really a team. And I think at a school campus, it's really important because we often really work in kind of that silo mentality as educators. So each teacher is in their classroom with their kids doing their work. And it's very difficult sometimes for a teacher to exit that room, go to another person, ask for help, offer to collaborate, invite collaboration. I think in a school site, not having a sense of community will really limit the real work that can be done. Because when we do the same thing all day long, all by ourselves, we really are not challenged to do better or to do different. But if I don't have trust, if I don't have opportunity to connect, and I don't have shared experiences with other teachers on my site, I'm never going to exit that silo unless I absolutely have to. So I would say at a school site, it's a huge, huge, it's of huge importance for the work. But it's also of really huge importance just for the well-being of people at a work site. Mm. So, you know, harms happen. You know, people are human beings, and they are going to have conflict. And so if we don't have community, and you know, it's just the basic root of restorative practice, right? It's a basic root of restorative justice is, you know, that philosophy that if I really have seen you and I really know you, then I'm going to value you higher than if you're just a stranger to me. So hopefully I will harm you less. But if I do harm you, I'm more likely to want to make things as right as possible, right? Like I'm going to want to mend a relationship that I have. If I don't have a relationship, not only am I more likely to stumble into conflict and harm with you, but I'm less likely to be motivated to make things as right as possible. So that's really important too. Not just that the work would be better, but that the work life would be better. That I would want to go I would want to go to the site. I would want to go to work, you know, and I would want to have that joy. And as a leader at a school site, I take that responsibility really seriously. It's my responsibility to provide opportunities for that community to be built. I have to provide space for it, and I have to provide routines and practices for it. And that's really important too, because restorative justice takes time and space, right, to do. And so having routines for creating community is really important. So one of the things that we do here, and you and I did it before we started recording, was checking in. Right? So before we do any business at my site of any kind, we check in 1 to 5, always. Now, sometimes we check in by holding numbers up in the room, 1 to 5. Sometimes we turn and talk and check in. When we're on Zoom, we do it in a variety of ways. Sometimes we put it in the chat. Sometimes we do numbers and show them. And then, you know, the other thing is the encouragement of follow-up. Checking in and building community just to say that we did it is not real. It doesn't create the kind of vulnerability that we're really after to build community. So if I see a 3 out of 5 or I see a 2, I need to make a note of that and make sure that I have an opportunity to check in with that person at a later time. So that check-in is a part of building relationship and building community, not just a one and done. And then we also at our site encourage people to check in with each other. If you have relationship with someone and you saw that they had a 3 or under, you know, make a note and make sure that you check in with that person. Mm-hmm. If no one checks in with you and you need a check-in, I'm going to ask you to take care of yourself on that and find somebody to say, hey, I don't think you saw my 3. You know, I need to be checked on. I need a connection. I'm communicating to you by my 3 or my 2 that I need help.
You know, I think about the work of expectation and setting expectations and of work and worth and the ways in which with students and with young people, we as adults, as educators in schools, have to set that bar and make that unexpected outcome. And so, but often in the work of culture building, that expectation is not placed for adults to be accountable for how they feel for conflict. And so I'm super appreciative to hear that. Was there any rumbling or any gaps of acceptance that you experienced in this culture work, and how did you attempt to fill in some of those gaps or bring folks into their own accountability of how they feel and how they feel is important?
Really good question. So, you know, when I first came to this site, some of this was new, you know, to folks here. And you know, every school takes on a different culture, a different way of being. And this was something that was just not negotiable to me. It was so important to me. And it's not just because I know the research, you know, and I know the work. It's also because I have grown to require it, you know, and I would like to create a working environment here or be part of creating a working environment here that I thrive in too, you know, that I feel community and I feel a part of, and I want to model that for our kids. So it was not negotiable to me. But there's a restorative way to create expectations around community building. You know, it's, again, we don't want to do things to people, right? So how do I then do things with people? And so, when we first started, I did my best to explain the context and the purpose for it. I did my best, and I always participate. Always. I never ask for others in the room to be checking in and I'm not participating also. Always participating. But the one piece of feedback that I got that was really powerful, and it was, you know, just something that I had really overlooked, and it is a restorative ask. What this teacher asked me was, you know, I'd really like for you to ask my permission. Like, I would like for you to ask me, like, if I'm willing to share my number. Mm. And it was something so simple, and it was not a very tall order. Like, that was not too much to ask, and it was so restorative. And he asked me in private. It was lovely, you know, and I thought, wow, you know, how did I miss that? You know, and so that has been very much a part of our new practice is, you know, if you are feeling comfortable or if you are willing, you know, to join us in a check-in, this is how we're going to be checking in this morning. And I have seen on occasion a couple of people not participate, very rarely, but that act of asking, you know, permission or inviting people to participate rather than requiring that people check in, it's a requirement that I provide the opportunity, but the way that I provide it is really key to that one individual, and it was clearly to other people who chose then not to participate, but then isn't that information? Mm-hmm. They've still checked in with me in a way that requires a further check-in. You know, and so I have, as the school leader, I've still gotten the data, you know, or the connection. I've still gotten what I need, which is that person and that person probably need to see my face today, you know, or maybe the assistant principal, maybe if she has a little closer relate, you know, whoever it is on our leadership team. And we will, at the close of a meeting like that, when we see threes and twos, or we see someone not engaged and check in, we will check in after who has so-and-so. You know, that's what we'll say. I have so-and-so, you know, I will. And we will make that commitment to go and just ask what's happening. You know, the most restorative question that we can ask in opening, you know, a one-on-one check-in like that is just what's happening. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is really important. And I, Gilbert, I think you and I have talked about this maybe before, but, you know, it's such an important question. It's such an important way to open restorative conversation, or one that has the potential to be restorative. Because when we say what's wrong, we've already passed judgment, you know, that, and we've already assessed, you know? So saying what's happening allows that person to tell their story in from whatever place they actually are living, you know, instead of from a what's wrong, and then they are expected to somehow share something that is going on that maybe they don't want to share, or maybe nothing is going on, you know, and yeah. Just what's happening has it. So we actually have an expectation at our site that that is how we address our students also. Mm. So when our students come into the office, sent to us or arriving at their own will, whatever the case may be, the opening question is always, hey, what's happening? And that is, you know, that is an expect. That's an expectation. That's a restorative routine system. It's a restorative expectation here.
The response of the teacher reminds me of when a few years ago, I went back to my undergrad to CSU Monterey Bay to give a keynote in the Service Learning Awards. I used to be a Service Learning student leader, and I met with some former professors and had breakfast with one, Dr. Catherine Potig, who was my Global Studies advisor. Mm-hmm. She's the chair of Global Studies. And I was telling her about my work of RJ's a few years ago, and I hadn't seen her in a long time. And I remember, I'll never forget the thing she said to me when I was talking to her about this work was, she said, you always do amazing work. And then she said, we don't live in a culture of consent, and you're helping to build that. And I always remember that. And I think about, you know, the reason why we tell folks who we train, there's the option to pass the talking piece in circle. You know, there's the teachers will ask me, what if a student has to be removed? How do you remove a student? There's like all of those questions. And I think in this context around consent, it makes me think about how this work is so much larger than the practices that we do and how it helps the potential to create this culture of consent, or to this culture of permission to share, this culture of to be invited to share. Is there a certain information or knowledge that we feel adults need to be able to share that we know there's a positive school environment?
So I'm thinking of it from two different ways. So one of the things is like, what do people really need to know about each other? Right. Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about creating a culture of positive community, like when we're thinking about that, you know, just saying being connected or building connections, that's so vague, you know. So what are some of the things that people would probably need to know about each other, or what things would be helpful for people to know, need to know about each other? And I think, you know, over time, people will hear each other's stories. Over time, as trust is built, people will know each other's stories. And that's the ultimate, right? Where I can look around a room and I know some of the big stuff about people. But that's not gonna be the first year that you're leading a school in these practices with adults. It's not. It may be one or two, or a handful of folks will go to that place. But how do we get closer to that? And so to me, there are two things that I really like to encourage folks to share. One is their why, you know, and that's kind of a trendy, you know, kind of cliche thing that we do in businesses. What's your why? But you know what? I still believe in it. Just because it's popular doesn't mean it's not good, you know, to know. And so when I, and your why, some folks will go real deep and share a very personal why that may even be rooted like in trauma, right? some people will share a why that's a little bit more superficial or career oriented, you know, but at any rate, kind of knowing people's why, it kind of lets you know why they show up to work every day. Right. And so it helps me as a leader, but it also helps with colleagues to know kind of what makes them tick, what motivates them, what excites them, kind of what they're about. So I think what's your why is kind of a, it's kind of a neat thing to go to at the beginning, and it can grow for people. But I think another is, what are you working on? Right. So I want to work in an environment with other adults who are working on something. Because as soon as I think I have arrived, I am in big trouble. That is not good. Anytime I think I've accomplished or that I have figured something out, I am destined for failure, right? So creating a culture at a school site of connection around growth. And if that's personal growth, that's great. If it's professional growth, that's great. But that everybody is openly speaking about and sharing what they're working on. And so those are things that I, as a school leader, or if I'm going into a new site and I get an opportunity to work through restorative practices, or my goal is to build community among adults, I'm going to be working on those themes for a while with people and creating questioning and activities that allow for sharing on those things. But then, you know, the other part of your question is, okay, so how do I know then? You know, if my goal is to work through those, just knowing what everybody's why is and knowing what everybody's working on isn't going to let me know that I have school culture that's positive and that people are, you know, building community. I think there are a lot of other measures. I mean, one is a really traditional measure. We have an outstanding core survey process in our school district, which that's a really super traditional, like, but I'm just going to get that away out of the way right away. Is that every single person on this site asks some pretty meaty questions about what it feels like to work here. Okay, so there, that's one thing. But I don't get that information but once a year. So how do I know then on the daily that this is a positive place, that people feel like working here, and that people feel like they want to come back here? And I think when people start approaching each other with concerns that are about that other person rather than coming to me with those concerns, right? So when two teachers are working on something and it's not going well, or two teachers are in conflict and it's not going well, but they figure out how to work it out together, and they don't come to me individually asking for help is okay. I think, you know, what I'm getting at is when they haven't even tried to, you know, they just come to me as the solver, you know, that, and I know it's going well when there's very little of that happening. You know, when people are working things out, you know, when people are convening their own conversations around conflict, because conflict's going to happen. So the absence of conflict is not the measure. Mm-hmm. It's that conflict is being worked through in ways that we've been modeling, you know, through restorative practices on our leadership team. I think another is when people enjoy coming to meetings, and they right? And people show up on time, you know, for a meeting. Show up expecting good to happen. You know, that's an actual, like, palpable, like, that's a feeling that you can get in a room when everybody arrives for the faculty meeting and it feels like it's all right. And there's a buzz, you know, that I think is one where people really clearly enjoy working and playing together. People are willing to take risks at play and at work, are measures. When people easily show appreciation for each other, when it's just easy, when you offer an opportunity for people to express appreciation and you have to stop because we've been doing it for a half hour and we got other stuff we got to do. Like, that is the beauty of a positive workplace. I mean, we have a practice here at Stanford. We have one of the themes that we've been working through since I came to our school is unlocking learning through relationships. So really, really communicating through that language on a daily basis, that the learning only happens in the context of relationship. That's it. That's the whole thing. That's the whole truth. And so without those relationships, learning, that child is learning on their own. It's not because of anything that we're doing. You know, the relationship is really what gives us access to that child's learning. So we use these big giant keys. They're huge keys, and we have 9 of them. And our teachers pass those around each month, and they express appreciation, not just thank you for holding the door for me when I had a lot of stuff kind of appreciation, but deeper than that. Our teachers are really tasked with communicating their appreciation for relationship building efforts. So they're really looking at each other through that lens of that teacher is doing everything they can to invite that child into their classroom community, or that teacher is really doing everything they can to decrease the amount of times they're excluding kids from their class, or, you know, and so that, I think when we offer up the opportunity to pass those keys and people just go on and on in their love for one another, I think we're in a position where, you know, people are doing well. And attendance too. That's just, and I just can't even tell you, I was so grateful. And, you know, our site is not perfect. It's not perfect. But it's so fun to see the growth, and it's so fun to see the highlights. And a highlight that I have here is that we had 100% attendance the day after back to school night this year. Mm-hmm. You know, and back to school night is a rough, like, thing for teachers. Like, they're exhausted. It comes in September. It's 10,000 degrees in their classrooms. We don't have air conditioning. They've made these beautiful presentations for parents. They are, you know, their rooms just look like somebody's, you know, having a giant party. And the next day, I'm telling you, you can barely get out of bed. And so, you know, they're so tired. Everybody came to work. And I literally, like, I looked at the absence board and I said, you know, to our office staff, who's out today? Did somebody forget to put the, you know, who's out today? Nobody. You know, so to me, those are things that we can really be looking at. And if those things aren't happening, it's really important for us to look then at our leadership team. It's really to evaluate our community building practices, you know, just because we think our intention is good. You know, if the impact really isn't there, we need to shift the practices, and we need to be asking for feedback. And we can do that in a lot of ways, you know, but that's what I would think would be a few ways that you could kind of do a check.
Thank you for all of that wisdom and for those specific practices and stories. If moving towards an observation and an idea that the work of culture and relationships and justice can be much more challenging with adults than with young people, a question of what has been your own journey as a white person, as an educator in working with students of color and with colleagues of color? And what do white folks, white educators working in schools need to know of how to engage in a culture of justice and relationships?
Wow.
Get it, Suzanne.
Yeah, so this is so big, right? And this is really at the root of the work that myself as a white person, you know, this is where the work is. And so I'm going to try hard not to speak for all white people, you know, at this point, because it's not restorative, but I may slip into I may do that. And I just want to say that my intention is to speak for myself at this point. But, you know, for me, I was raised in an environment that was, you know, pretty insulated, you know, white upon white upon white, you know, and so my experience was, you know, very much a white experience. And I didn't have a lot of access to, you know, opportunities to be in relationships with people who didn't look like me, particularly not Black students. I did not have Black friends as a child. And so, in my family, and in my experience as a white person, I knew as a child that it was rude to use to name a person's race. Like, that is how I was enculturated, right, into whiteness, is that we weren't to talk about a person's race or to name a person's race. And even to say the word race was, like, it was impolite. To talk about that was impolite. So I had zero experience talking about race when I became an adult. I had no experience. And at the same time, to be fair, I'd never really had much cause. to talk about it because I was white. I'd never really thought about being white before. You know, and so I'd never really talked about that. So, and I think too, I was very much raised and experienced. And when I say raised, I'm not talking just about my parentage, right? I'm just talking about my mom and dad told me these things, you know, it's bigger than that. As I think as a white person, I am learning how much bigger it is than just my parents. And the rules or the things that they model for me, it's so much bigger than that. And I was so much a believer in this whole like good, bad binary, you know, that racists were bad and non-racists were good. Like that's how you measured someone's worth. And so as I became an adult and I chose teaching as a profession, I worked in a super diverse, I came to Long Beach. You know, and so I worked in Long Beach and I worked in a place that was not anything like where I had been raised and where I had gone to school. So in the very beginning, Gilbert, I had a lot of students of color in my class, and very, very few white students. But I realized right away that my focus on the difference, I did not want to articulate that what was different between me and my students was race. I wanted to talk about class. Right? So I wanted to talk about poverty and I wanted to make the difference about that because talking about race was rude. It was impolite. It was racist, you know, to talk about race or to acknowledge that some of my struggles to understand my students were about my whiteness. I wanted it to be about my middle classness. And so I struggled hard, like really hard. And, you know, I was listening to a podcast actually just this morning where Robin DiAngelo was talking about the fact that white people can sometimes be totally oblivious of race and totally aware of race at exactly the same time. Mm. And that's a part of the problem, right? So I'm aware then of everybody else's race, but I'm totally unaware of my race and the impact that my identity is having just by my being in the room because of, you know, white supremacy, right? So that all was happening. And so then when I kind of became aware of that, and I allowed myself to really be aware of the real difference and the real tension was around race, then I had to do the whole white guilt thing, right? I had to go through all that. Then I had to do the whole white savior thing, right? I was going to fix everyone and everything. And I was going to provide my service to people. And it was, you know, it's at the time I didn't know better. Now, should I have known better? Absolutely. I'm absolutely not giving myself any excuses, but I think it's an important context that a lot of us or that I experienced. And, you know, then I went to, CCJ and, you know, basically like, and this was years though, right? So it was years of just real ignorance, you know, to my place in space and what that really meant for my ability to work with students and my ability to be effective in the classroom and my ability to provide a place where people could actually learn. Mm-hmm. You know, because if learning is only unlocked through relationships, then I was in big trouble, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, went to CCJ and I had an opportunity to go to camp. And wow, I mean, that really, I mean, CCJ Building Bridges Camp, I'm not overplaying this. Life changing, completely changed the trajectory of my growth, right? Like I didn't come home from camp a different person. That's not possible. But I came home from camp knowing who I wanted to be and that I wasn't that person. And I came home from camp knowing that I didn't really know how to get there either. And that I wanted to figure that out. And I knew that I needed people, you know, to help me with that. And so, you know, I just got immersed in the culture of personal growth in like racial awareness and understanding whiteness and understanding just that I didn't understand. So, you know, but that led to, of course, some performative allyship, right? So it's not you go to camp or you read one book. Like this is a lifestyle of personal growth. Like this is, it's not, it's just not over. You know, it continues, and there's layers upon layers of things that we don't know. And, you know, some of the best getting up for me has been after a fall down. So I welcome the fall down. I don't love it when that fall down ends up harming someone, absolutely. But when I do something really backwards about, you know, it's like I'm so grateful when I have people around me who are willing to check me on that and help me to move forward. So, but it is a slow process, and I definitely suffer still from periodic white fragility. I mean, I've done some really dumb stuff, you know, and then somebody checks me on it, and I've done some of those white fragile things that I'm not proud of, you know. And I think I'm sharing that, Gilbert, because, you know, I just think that we need to be right where we are, you know. And I think that's how we get better at this, and that's how we grow, is from, you know, from not performing in this, but from revealing in this where we are and how we're moving forward. So, you know, the thing about the white fragility, right? So, so I was watching this woman on Instagram, and I wrote her name down because I wanted to make sure that I said her name. So her name is Sonia Renee Taylor, and she's about kind of this process. I learned something just this month from her about what she calls the white supremacy delusion, or a white worldview. And she talks about masking right action with wrong motive. So I was like, okay, so what does that look like? And she described this idea of white people apologizing to people of color for mistakes and things like that with the goal of absolution. Right? So this is how we tie back to restorative justice, right? So in restorative justice, like, we don't really talk a lot about apologizing, right? We talk about making things right. So what she was talking about is, when I make a mistake as a white person, I better not apologize to someone if I'm expecting them to turn around and say that's okay. Or I'm expecting, if like the reason that I go to apologize to someone is because I want them to make me feel better, I'm in a really bad space, and I need to stay away from that activity, right? So I want to tell you that in the last year, I did a super white fragile thing, and I have resisted apologizing because I haven't yet been ready to just apologize. I want that person to forgive me. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to tell you the exact situation because I haven't asked permission from this other person, but I was actually doing some work in a racial affinity group, so with other white people, and I did something offensive, right? Like, it was without my knowledge, but I still did it, right? Intent and impact. It still hurt somebody. Mm-hmm. So that was brought to my attention by another person. So it was brought to my attention by a person of color, and I fell apart. I could not resist that old behavior, right? And so I did not respond restoratively. I did not respond maturely. I responded in total white fragility, totally, totally. And then I went through this process that Sonia Renee Taylor talks about, where I rehearsed apologies over and over and over again, but they always ended with that person saying, that's okay. You're okay. You're still a good person. And I knew that was wrong because of my restorative justice training, but through learning about whiteness further, through like continuing my journey in learning about whiteness, I have resisted the temptation to apologize because I'm still not ready to just have it be about the apology and have it be about making it right. I'm still not ready to do that. Hopefully after this podcast, I'll be ready, because I've just verbally totally processed it with you, Gilbert. So thank you very much. But I, you know, that's the journey for me personally. But, you know, I think what you asked me is, so what do white educators working in schools need to know or do, right? And I, you know, I think the first thing is we have to learn. So white people need to learn. And how do we do that? So how do I do that? What was my experience? And I would say, read. So we have to learn about white privilege. We have to learn about white supremacy culture. We have to learn about Black history. And we have to read the books. We have to listen to the podcasts. We have to go to the webinars, right? We have to do that. And it has to be, I'm like talking about like daily right now, right? That's what I'm daily. I'm listening to my car, you know, to stuff all the time, trying to learn more. You know, and there's a ton of books. Oh my gosh, there's so many great things. Now, I am of the school that white fragility is a really good place to start. Now, I know there's different schools of thought on that. I mean, what do you think, Gilbert? I mean, do you think white fragility is a place to start for white people?
So I just wrote a, you know, there's a piece in Colorizing. The book is called Colorizing Restorative Justice, and I'm a contributing author to it. And I write about white fragility, and I write about an experience that we at CCJ had in a trauma training where two trainers, that are both white women, were asking us to do things around our own trauma without consent or permission and without even participating in their own experiences as people. And so it was a very power, it was not power with, it was power to. And there had been constant requests and constant expressions of the way that which we were feeling. Training had to finish early, and then there was a huge moment of white fragility, a huge moment of I do this work because, and then naming their proximity to Blackness, and the fragility moment was in pausing the space, and somebody got up to leave, and to telling the person who was a Black man to stay in the space because my experience of this is powerful and strong, and you need to hear it essentially. And so that moment of, I write about the way that which white fragility has paused the space, and the way that the use of that vulnerability I've seen in training spaces as a mean to have it all be centered on the reaction and response of this person. Which there's a complexity of, I think, in a restorative mindset, you know, everyone's responses and reactions are valid, but the complexity of you need to listen to me and my moment, my experience right now is so powerful that you need to listen to me, and often there's no follow-up or no question. In my experience, in these moments that I write about in their experience, there's not a space to hear a reaction from someone else. And so it's just and in my own experience as a colleague working with a white woman, there was a moment when I had activated her, and we were across the table, and she had said to me, Gilbert, when you look at me like that, I feel like you're out to something, get me something. And the way I think I was looking at her was trying to figure out what it was that I think I had done. And I was so, it was a moment of my own self as in this male body and in patriarchy and masculinity and male privilege around like, what did I do? And it was a moment of me feeling harmed. And then I went to her and I asked, you know, I was about to ask, can we have a conversation? And there was just I can't talk to you. I'm not going to talk to you. And so I think of that, the where white fragility I think could be harmful is around, I'm not going to talk to you and I'm not going to engage with you. And so I think that vulnerability, you know, shared joy and vulnerability build meaningful connection. And I write about, and I cite different authors who talk about, how vulnerability can be hijacked and how vulnerability can be not of service to dialogue or community or building relationship. And so I think white fragility without accountability, I think maybe is harmful, but white fragility with accountability or in the space that I hear from you of the space of trying to do the internal work to be able to take accountability and not ask for forgiveness or reconciliation, but just to name accountability. I think that's where it's impactful and powerful. that moment for me of the White Fragility that I experienced as a, you know, in my 20s was, again, I don't know specifically what harming behavior I might have been doing. I don't know if there was a reaction or activation from her that I was doing. I will never know that, because there, in spite of my asking for a dialogue, it never occurred. And mm-hmm. so without that, I don't know what to be accountable to. But I was glad that I experienced that harm, because I think it's important for men to experience how they can be harming and harmful. I think, you know, to answer your question, I think for me, I think at this moment in my experience, white fragility without accountability is, I think, when it's harmful.
Well, I think that what I was thinking really, Gilbert, is like the starting place for learning.
Mm.
So to me, I think the first book that white people, if they want to start this work, like they've never read anything about race. They've never, you know, they have not started. I think the first book is White Fragility, because mm-hmm. I think that it will reveal, you know, some of what you're talking about that harmed you. You know, people who are in touch with the fact that that is a go-to reaction sometimes for white people, you know, what you're talking about as far as a trauma training particularly. That centering my own experience stuff is white fragility, right? So if I've read the book, I have access at least to the possibility that I engage in that behavior. You know, I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying is, like, I think that's if I'm going to suggest a book, and our people, 25 of our teachers just finished that book together this summer, because I think that it does explain because I think white people are afraid of race, and I think they don't have racial stamina, you know, which is what mm-hmm. Robin DiAngelo talks about, that we don't have the vocabulary, we don't have the experience talking about it. So I think it is a good starting place, but I don't think that white people should stop there. Mm-hmm. Because I think it centers whiteness, right? So you read White Fragility and that's it. Then it's all about you all over again as a white person, you know? So I think that moving on and really reading some of these other scholars, and I mean, I cannot, like, the list goes on and on, right? Of the scholars that are writing and have written some really amazing things that are challenging and that are, you know, honestly, like, motivating, helpful, instructive, requiring, you know, I think How to Be an Anti-Racist, So You Want to Talk About Race is mm-hmm. unbelievable. And Ijoma Oluo, I practiced saying her name because she, I want to say it again. Ijoma Oluo she is, oh my gosh, right? Like, I would love to meet her because I want to hear more, not because I want to say more, right? So she's a remarkable individual writer. So You Want to Talk About Race. There's a group of us that are reading We Want to Do More Than Survive, Bettina Love. And then, I don't know if you're familiar, but Bettina Love has started she and a team started the Abolitionist Teacher Network. Mm. And there are some awesome webinars. And they are doing racial affinity webinars, which are really outstanding. So I recommend that people do that. Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Beverly mm-hmm. Taylor. Oh my gosh, right? You've read it.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkable, right? Yeah, I recommend it. And I think it also really helps adults to understand why racial affinity work is so important.
Mm.
And you know, that's something that I would recommend for people too, is if they haven't ever participated in, you know, racial affinity work. A lot of the work that we're doing in Long Beach is, you know, multi-identity work. It's multi-race. And I think that in my experience with CCJ, you know, there's so much value in doing racial affinity work. In fact, I actually reached out and said, can you show me some literature? Because I know from my personal experience why it works for me and why why I think it's working for others, but can you show me great things so that I could read more about how to explain that to other people who are resistant, you know, to the work in that context. So yeah, I mean, I would suggest doing a whole bunch of reading or doing a whole bunch of reading just to listen, you know, just to listen. Because, I mean, as a white woman, like, I've spent years you know, talking about what I know, what I think, what I feel, what my experience has been, me, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think as a white woman, to my suggestion to other white people is to even set goals for yourself in groups, you know, to not be the first to speak, you know, to set kind of silent standards for yourself around that. You know, there's this many people in the room. There's this many minutes for this conversation. An equal amount would be this, and I need to make sure I'm well under that. You know, that's thinking that kind of thing through. Mm-hmm. I think can be helpful, not just because we want to performatively not participate, but because we want to listen. That's why.
And particularly calling in white men to step back into that, to think of how often they choose to speak in particular, is another very helpful feature of to build community, to be in space.
Yeah. And then reflect, you know, that's the reading everything, consuming everything there is to consume, listen to people, listen, and then, you know, spend that time doing that reflection, you know, really doing that reflection. When I'm watching, you know, that woman who's talking about absolution, like when she started talking about that, I mean, if I hadn't been listening, I would have missed that. You know, it's like, listen, consume this, you know, really, because there's opportunity for all of us to grow exponentially. And in this time, people are producing amazing work, you know? I mean, this is a time of like miraculous creativity too, right? In publication and in performance and in public speaking. And I just consume, because it's all there for us, you know? And then spend that quiet time, you know, really meditate on those things, you know, that are instructive for us and that are going to kind of redefine, you know, our position on things. And that has definitely happened to me. Like I can't even like just the epiphanies, you know, that I have been able to experience through, you know, through listening to people. So
bringing us back to this time, what is your vision for a school after this pandemic? What is your vision for a community after this pandemic? Or as we are virtual, in what ways also, I guess, three questions, how have you been able to sustain relationships with folks in this virtual space?
Wow, right? The pandemic.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in thinking about how the pandemic helped to push this huge eruption and consciousness for many folks as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's the best of times and the worst of times. You know, uh-huh. I mean, it's like looking at the opportunity for what's happening in racial justice, you know, kind of that margin that's been created, you know, the space, you know, to be in action, you know, is really powerful. And then from the school site perspective, yeah, I have really struggled with the fear of missed opportunity. Like I'm struggling with that. Like I feel so excited that our site took the opportunity to do a couple book studies, you know, so they just finished the White Fragility and they're just starting How to Be an Anti-Racist. So like, that's super exciting that they're taking advantage of that. And then we also have a group of students, it's very small, with one of our ELA teachers who's doing a Project Lit book study over the summer. And they've read a few things and I participated with them in their review of Ghost Boys, which was you know, powerful. And
yeah.
Oh my gosh, it was just such a, you know, there's something so special about being in a book club with young people and listening to their experience with a piece of literature that has that kind of pain and that kind of reflection and power and history, and listening to them all kind of work through that. So those things that are happening still at our site over the summer during the pandemic give me hope of what's possible during the school year, right? Because if we can do that over the summer, we can continue the movement. during the pandemic. We can continue the movement. But that is, honestly, as a school leader, that is my responsibility. That is my moral imperative. That is the reason that I exist at this time as a school leader. Without racial justice, there is no justice at my school site. With achievement gaps, there is no achievement. We cannot celebrate success that is for one group or a group that marginalizes other groups. Like, we can't celebrate, right? So knowing that, this is it. This is what I need to do. So I can't let this be a missed opportunity. I cannot give in to the pandemic and not move the work forward as a school leader. So what does that look like? You know, I think that it looks like continued small group conversation over technology. It looks like continuing that. So last year, our assistant principal here, Nicole Reyes, is a complete genius and rock star. This woman is amazing. So she started a racial affinity group here called Umoja. And then we had a parent component also. So somewhat like a concerned African-American parents unit, but specific to our site and very much more a work group than an information sharing group. And so that work needs to continue. You know, that work absolutely needs to continue. That, you know, our Black parents and our Black students would still have opportunity to experience racial affinity project-based, like we're gonna do, and they did. They did this brilliant Black History Month showcase is what they called it, and it was multi-school. They invited other schools to participate. I mean, it was just a remarkable and first experience for our site to have something like that. But, you know, seeing our parents come to our site and really watching a shared joy and vulnerability experience with those families at our site. So figuring out how to continue that work here. How do we continue? We did here at our site a series of PDs that we only got halfway through because March 13th happened and we all went home. But we did a lot of the work that I learned and experienced through CCJ. So we did some, we called it implicit bias training to begin, right? So we did some identity work first. And then we moved into some implicit bias training where we really looked at head, heart, hand, institution, head, heart, hand, institution. So this cycle of implicit bias or stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination, and institutionalized racism, right? Because that then breeds, again, more stereotyping, more prejudice, more discrimination. So it's that cycle, right, that we are somehow stuck in as a school site and as a district, as a community, and so on. As a nation. So we did a lot of that work here with our teachers, which, you know, but I feel like it was like chapter one. You know, there's so much more, you know, that I want to do with them, you know, have more of this journey with them. So I'm really glad you asked me that because I know you kind of, I think, started the question with like after the pandemic, you know, but the time is now. For me, I can only speak for myself and my experience in my school site. This is the time. And if I am, you know, I am a white woman with a tremendous amount of privilege and influence at this site, right? It is up to me. I cannot give myself a pass because of the pandemic. It's not acceptable. So there will be work that will continue, and it's going to be humbling. You know, but I would rather do that, you know, that work that is than miss, you know, miss an opportunity to move my kids forward. This is their middle school experience. This is it. Pandemic or not, this is eighth grade. And so I need to make every effort to make it, you know, this is their life. You know, today is their life. So, you know, and as far as like after the pandemic, yeah. And it will continue. You know, that'll be chapter three, right? Where hopefully we have an opportunity to come together. You know, and I've been looking at and we actually had some of our teachers did virtual circle in the spring. Beautiful. I participated with one of our teachers, Stephanie Heyer, outstanding job with creating closure with her class through a like classic circle arc, you know, of questioning and, you know, can't necessarily pass a talking piece, but going, you know, she stated the order. But I've also seen some teachers online doing, you know, some visual where they place all the children's names in a circle to know that your turn's coming. I mean, there's just, we are not going to use this as an excuse to not move this work forward, Gilbert, right?
Yeah. And there's so much creativity, like you were saying, and I've done things virtually in trainings that in the middle of March, the end of March, I said, no, I can't do community building training online. And with the partnership of an AP, we did it. And it was really amazing. All the things that we do in day one community building, we did virtually. And so, yeah. And I think also like the ways in which the technology is really helpful, you know, like I don't have to take notes of what someone says. It could be in the chat. And so there was ways that I think enriched a lot of the things that I was doing hand to paper. So creativity is powerful and strong. Circles are possible. Games are possible virtual. Yeah. To close us out in the spirit of this work, I have an invitation for us. Choose somebody, fictional, real, alive, no longer on this earth, that we would want to individually or collectively be in a community building circle.
You go first.
I would love to sit in a community building circle with great grandparents, none of which are no longer on this earth, but like I would love to sit in circle with them and like ask a question about what was their favorite game when they were little, or that would be my desire. Grandparents. Okay. What about you? Circle.
I would like to be in a community building circle with my high school teachers from my senior year.
Oh.
But with a goal to just kind of learn more about just that culture, that experience. I want to know more about those people, because I think it'll inform my experience, because it was a formative experience, right? Your senior year in high school for some folks, it's formative. So I would like to know a little bit more. I'd like to just hear more storytelling around what it was to be a teacher at that school in 1989. There you go, Gilbert, 1989. I just gave it to you. Right there.
I'm super grateful to you for your time and whatever courage, whatever vulnerability you had to bring into this space.
Thank you, Gilbert. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Anytime. Thank you. So let me just say that was Wichinova RJ, sharing stories and skills about restorative justice, a podcast of CCEJ. Please visit our website, caceej.org, for more information. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Thank you.